This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, Tan Chung Han and Julian Ng. 7:35 right now as we take a look at the biggest business news of the day. Of course, all eyes are on the UK as 9 months after Britain voted to leave the EU, Tim Barrow, Britain's ambassador to the bloc, had hand-delivered a letter to the European Council President Donald Tusk yesterday, formally notifying the bloc that the UK will be the first member state ever to leave it. Now, this was Theresa May announcing the news to Parliament.
The Article 50 process is now underway, and in accordance with the wishes of the British people, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back. Britain is leaving the European Union. We are going to make our own decisions and our own laws. We are going to take control of the things that matter most to us. And we are going to take this opportunity to build a stronger, fairer Britain, a country that our children and grandchildren are proud to call home. That is our ambition and our opportunity. And that is what this government is determined to do.
Theresa May there, Prime Minister of the UK, notifying Parliament about the triggering of Article 50. Now, you know, for some, the Brexit symbolises, you know, long-sought freedom from the European Union. For others, it signifies a loss to the UK. But in response to receiving this letter, Donald Tusk, the President of the European Council, he had some regret and some sadness. In fact, he said that there's no reason to pretend this is a happy day, neither in Brussels nor in London. We already miss you.
Oh, and, you know, the tone for Theresa May was also conciliatory.
It was, but here's Donald Tusk describing just how sad he is after the possible loss of the UK.
There is nothing to win in this process, and I'm talking about both sides. This is about damage control. Our goal is clear: to minimize the cost for the EU citizens, businesses and member states.
So do you think it was conciliatory, Julian? I mean, even though clearly the EU, this is not what the EU wanted, right?
Yeah, I think that it was conciliatory, but there's no turning back to all this. I mean, Theresa May said that, you know, she promised to represent every person in the UK and also added that she would do all that they can to help the European Union prosper and succeed. I think that is politician speak for, hey, we can still work together, right? Let's not turn this into a disaster.
Every person in the UK, including the Scottish folk, they're saying, you don't speak for us, Theresa May. We're going to go and do our own thing. That's a terrible Scottish impersonation, by the way.
I didn't know that you were even doing that.
I know. So essentially, now that the Article 50 has officially been invoked, it kickstarts that countdown. You know, could be 2 years from now, perhaps sooner. Some even say 18 months before that divorce is officially done and dusted between the UK and the EU.
I think this is also a political test for Theresa May, who has a small majority in Parliament. She would have to convince some of the more right-wing lawmakers in her Conservative Party who want a complete cutting of ties with Brussels. And in addition to that, Scotland as well, who likes the EU because the English don't. So the Scottish must like them. And they will have to decide on in a referendum whether they want to succeed.
Well, okay, so
from the UK,
the UK is going to be the first member of the EU to leave it, right? But is it going to be the last member to leave the EU? And what's the future of the EU going forward? Because with all these elections happening around Europe at the moment, the future of this union is in question.
Yeah, no, certainly. But then when you consider how the nationalist push in the Netherlands did not really succeed. So at least that somewhat helped ebb the push to succeed.
Well, but what about France?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. You know, yeah. So but when you look at France, you know, given the rise of Le Pen and the kind of headlines and certainly a lot of attention being accorded to her and her platform, you know, it certainly does stoke the concerns about the EU further crumbling.
I think that French situation is really, really very interesting because the two leading parties right now in the polls are parties that have never ruled the governments before. And one of them, of course, we all have heard about Marie Le Pen's National Front. And she's using words, right? The lingo is so scary. Global, are you a globalist or a patriot? And then the other party of the, you know, of Emmanuel Macron, Macron, I think that's the way you pronounce it, of the En Marche party, he used the other word, do you want it to be open or closed? So it's kind of like very different from the scenario of Donald Trump and the Brexit voters in the UK, in the sense that Donald Trump and the Conservative Party of the UK are part of the government, but these leading parties in France are not of the government.
Well, at least, you know, for the rest of the world outside of Europe, as we certainly monitor this developing situation, you know, there have been plenty of moves already. I mean, right here on this show, we talk about how the banks have been jostling, you know, or, you know, reassuring their staff. But also here in Malaysia, if you recall, just back in December, already you've got MDEC, which went over to the UK to sign deals, you know, with all kinds of companies over there.
And also, Qatar spending about over $6 billion into the UK.
Right, no, that's right. So, you know, there are some preemptive and some contingent contingency measures being put in place.
But what about those, you know, London is a financial centre, right? So what about the banks like Goldman Sachs and Nomura? Yesterday, they were all very nervous. They sent messages to their employees in London trying to, I guess, assure them that, you know, jobs are still okay, your clients will not leave. But whether that's really the case is anyone's guess, right?
And I think that the other thing is also the black swan of the collapse of the EU. I mean, if Marie Le Pen wins, then she is promising to take France out of the EU, and the European Union, as we know it, might collapse.
If France is not in, so there's a big if France is not in the EU, can the union, can the bloc survive without France in the UK?
Well, I don't know. France is a huge member of the European Union, a huge economy for the world as well. I think it's will make the EU teeter to a kind of collapse.
And I guess a lot of it also depends on what Germany, and by Germany I mean Angela Merkel, you know, what she has to say about all this. Because, I mean, ultimately, you know, I mean, many people say that Germany is the, you know, while being the largest economy, they are the sole guys, you know, propping up the EU.
They hold the purse strings.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, there are some comments that say that if Germany was taken out of the EU would be great, because right now every nation in there has to live up to the standards of Germany, and it's very hard for them to do it, and that's causing the kind of disenfranchisement that is leading to all these right-wing sentiments.
Toshiba has projected that its annual loss could more than double to a record $9.1 billion. And this is because its U.S. nuclear unit, Westinghouse Electric, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Yep, so about $10 billion of debt has been listed for Westinghouse, and the shares of Toshiba has come down about 23% this year after going up 13% last year. And interestingly, Westinghouse technology is the basis of about half of the world's nuclear power generation.
And this kind of news flow certainly you know, points, or it could be seen as a canary in the mines, you know, when you look at the global atomic power industry. You know, for example, you've got Germany's Siemens, they abandoned their nuclear business back in 2011. This is according to a Bloomberg article here. Areva, that's in France, they had to be bailed out by the French government. So here's a number to latch on to. Of the 754 reactors worldwide, 90 have been abandoned at various stages of construction. That includes in the US, and 12 of which belong to Westinghouse, which is what this story is about. You know, so essentially, you've got, you know, what you're seeing in the developed markets, at least. You know, the nuclear energy sector tends to be waning right
now. But in Malaysia, I mean, we just reported recently that the Integrated Nuclear Infrastructure Review report was going to be tabled to Cabinet soon. So we're, in fact, looking at this as a power source.
Right. Yeah, so in the long term, I think the nuclear power generation would be very cheap, but that has to be done over the very long term. In the short term, you have the plunge in oil prices and natural gas prices, making nuclear a lot more unattractive. And also there's, of course, Fukushima. So these two factors, the collapsing oil prices as well as Fukushima, threw a spanner in the works for Westinghouse, who couldn't keep to those very costly factors, and that's why Toshiba has found itself in the spot right now.
Well, speaking about fossil fuel energy, let's take a look at Saudi Arabia. They are cutting the tax rate paid by Saudi Aramco, their state-owned oil company. Now, this is ahead of Saudi Aramco's IPO, which is set to be the world's biggest IPO. This move should deliver a sizable uplift on Aramco's value, but will it be a dampener on Saudi Arabia's finances?
Well, not really. So just looking at the taxes alone, this has the potential to triple the reported profits for Aramco, which is going to be very attractive for the IPO investors. But because the Saudi government is only listing 5% of the company, this doesn't really hurt them from a budgetary viewpoint. In fact, if Aramco is going to pay a lot of these newfound profits in the form of dividends, it would actually help investors as well as the Saudi government. So this is a very, very clever trick to lure investors into a kind of bonanza.
Do you know the tax on income that was payable previously was 85%?
That's right.
And they cut it to 50%. But 85%, that's
But I mean,
crazy.
It's a left-hand to right-hand
yeah,
kind of
that's
thing because
true.
It's owned by the government. You're just passing revenues from one government entity to the government.
So this could just be like a token cut or a signal.
Yeah, no, because at the same time, like Julian pointed out, there's the dividend side of the equation as well. But then what I find interesting here from this story is that, because normally you would equate when it comes to tax brackets, the bigger you are or the richer you are, the more you pay.
Right.
But in this new tax structure, it's the opposite. The smaller you are, you pay more. So that 85% is those with capital below 225 billion riyals. And then as you go up higher, it gets to 75%, then 65%, then 50%. It's like, apa ni?
Don't tell Donald Trump that.
He might get some ideas.
Yeah. Okay, it's 7:46 right now. The ringgit trading offshore has slumped 70% since Bank Negara's curbs. We'll tell you more about that after this on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.